Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's not unusual for universities to require summer reading for incoming freshmen. This year, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill chose a book that's touched off a storm of controversy. Why? It's about the Quran. And though every freshman has to read it, not all of them want to. This hour, On Point, teaching the Quran in American public universities. We begin tonight in Chapel Hill. Chancellors at the University of North Carolina assigned Approaching the Quran by Michael Sells. The book contains excerpts and interpretations of the Muslim holy tract. The university has drawn fire for assigning Approaching the Quran as summer reading, and last week, three students, along with the Conservative Family Policy Network, took their objection one step further. They filed a lawsuit. Earlier today, I spoke with Robert Shelton, Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost for the University of North Carolina. I asked him why UNC assigned Approaching the Quran.
We chose Approaching the Quran for a number of reasons. As you know, it's part of our summer reading program, which is in its fourth year. And in every year, we've tried to pick a text that will stimulate intellectual discourse, that will be relevant to issues of current interest in society, and will introduce the incoming students to this type of discussion at the university.
Now, you've got how many incoming students? 3,500?
Approximately 3,500, maybe a little shy of that in the freshman class, and then a few hundred more transfer students.
And how many instructors are going to have to read this book as well in order to either discuss it with them or help teach it?
We'll have 20 to 25 in each discussion session. I'll get a chance to lead one of those. So that's about 160, if I did the math right.
What has your faculty said about having to suddenly get to be expert on a very difficult book?
The faculty that I've talked to, and this includes the faculty leadership and the faculty council, remain enthusiastic about the book. As I said, this is something we've done in the past with approximately the same numbers involved. Last year, in fact, our freshman class was a bit bigger. It was almost 3,700. And so the time and the effort, the commitment has been a constant over the last 3 or 4 years.
Have there been any complaints from the faculty about having to teach the Quran or understanding the Quran?
Yeah, I think the verb form is important here. We're not out to teach the Quran, but to take this book that has a few readings and a history of Islam in the front and engage in discussion. I personally have not had any complaints from the faculty about it. Now, we have a great variety of faculty who will be leading discussions. We have members of the university clergy, the Hillel and a number of the Christian religions here that will also be discussion leaders. So we're gathering discussion leaders from quite a variety of sources on campus. And again, I want to emphasize that that's typical of this program.
Now, the student body itself, what kind of response have you been getting from freshmen who are probably trying to soak up the last rays of summer before they become grown-ups?
As you can imagine, we're getting a variety of responses. I think the chancellor has received more emails and phone calls than I have, but I've received quite a number. In all candor, most of them have been critical and have been concerned.
Why do you think that is?
Well, and these are not coming from students, I should say.
No,
these
I understand.
Coming from parents or from people around the state. And I think the concern probably comes from a variety of reasons. Some people do feel that we're going to be teaching or proselytizing, and we try to reassure them that's not the intent. I think, with one exception, nobody that has called me has actually read the book or even parts of the book, and so it's a matter of getting the knowledge out there. And I think just the current atmosphere that we're in, with all of the tension that exists, if you say Quran, that's a trigger word for a lot of people.
Did you anticipate this problem?
I did not. I think it's safe to say that the campus did not. The unsettling part now is we're getting a lot of this concern, not from the students, but from others, and by and large, people that haven't read the book.
Now, there's a lawsuit.
Yes, there is.
And have you spoken at all with the students who are bringing the suit?
I have not, and I'm really not in a position to comment on the status of the lawsuit. In fact, we don't even know who the students are.
Do you have any regrets about assigning this book?
No, I think no regrets. I think it is important for us to be consistent and clear in all the messages we give to the students. This does not have an impact on any academic standing. There's no penalty if they choose not to do it. This is an exercise in conjunction with orientation. It's not an exercise in conjunction with the academics, the courses that they'll be taking once they arrive here.
Robert Shelton is Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost at the University of North Carolina. He spoke with me from Chapel Hill. Earlier today, I also talked with the man who filed the lawsuit against UNC on behalf of the three students. Stephen Crampton is Chief Counsel at the American Family Association Center for Law and Policy in Tupelo, Mississippi. I asked him why he was suing the university.
In effect, what they object to is the compulsory nature of the required reading here, and then the fact that what you get is not a critical look at the religion of Islam, not a choice of books, some of which are pro and some of which are con, but one book and one book only, which is by a man who is described on the book cover as a ranking Islamicist. He is very sympathetic in favor of the religion and paints a picture of a very peaceful religion.
Well, you know, I think that the interesting thing to me here is it that you object to the religious nature and that people are being compelled to read a book of a religious nature in a state-funded university? Well, or is it your belief that Mr. Sells is actually very pro-Islamic? I'm not quite sure exactly what that means because it's a loaded phrase now.
First of all, let me say, we have no problem and even encourage students to participate in elective offerings that do a comparative religion sort of study. Exposure is a good thing. I think we would agree with the university on that. The problem here is that it's not even-handed and that it is the state that's doing it.
But if it were a private entity,
we would have no objection. There's no First Amendment prohibition there.
But Steve, you know, here's the thing. I mean, the essence of going to university is that you learn to develop your critical faculties. And it would seem to me that a set of readings like this and Professor Sells' explication of them is only one step, and that there's a certain amount of responsibility on the student themselves, isn't there? If they see something that they question, in fact, they're being asked to write about it and to ask questions, that this helps them develop their critical faculties, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's a wonderful picture you paint, but I think you go way too far. The law will not permit that sort of undertaking where the state institution is going to throw at you everything that's good, positive, and beneficial in favor of the religion. That's called promotion of the religion, which Establishment Clause prohibits, and then force the student to go back and do his own reading if he's going to find anything that's critical, or even read the rest of the Quran itself, which sets forth all kinds of verses that are very violent in nature. Fight and slay the pagan wherever you find them, for instance, Surah 9:5. It's not included in the reading here.
Would we be having this conversation if the set text was the King James Version?
Yes, we would. Yes, we would. A lot of folks like to sort of make a caricature of us for bringing an action like this and say, well, you just object to the text. That's just flat not true, Michael. The truth is there is no business of the government to promote any religion, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Hindu, pick one. They just shouldn't be in that business. They do a bad job in a lot of academic areas. They do a horrendous job, and the dangers of indoctrination and forcing belief is just too great to permit it.
Well, I think that lawyers can argue over the meaning of the word promote, and doubtless that will come up in your lawsuit. But let me just ask you one last thing. If a quarter of a century ago, the University of North Carolina had set text for freshmen of Karl Marx's Das Kapital and a way of interpreting it written by a socialist, would you have objected? Here we are in the Cold War, and that secular text was as close to a religious text as there was for the Soviet Union. Would you have objected?
No. Again, the First Amendment singles out religion for special treatment in our nation. However much folks may object to Marxism on religious grounds, it is not a religious text, so it's governed by different standards.
Stephen Crampton is Chief Counsel at the American Family Association Center for Law and Policy. He spoke with me earlier from Tupelo, Mississippi. We're talking tonight about teaching the Quran in American public universities. Should the Quran be required reading at a university that's funded with taxpayer money? And how far should publicly funded schools go to teach students about religion? But we're going to branch out from that, and we're also going to ask, have you studied the Quran since the events of the September 11th? What have you learned? Has it been difficult? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now is the man whose book is at the center of the UNC controversy, Michael Sells, professor of comparative religion at Haverford College, author of Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations. Good evening, Michael Sells.
Good evening.
And also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, Michael.
Michael Sells, sympathetic. Yeah. Are you sympathetic? This is the accusation of Stephen Crampton. Are you sympathetic to the teachings of Islam?
Let me explain that that can be meant in two ways. The way Mr. Crampton presents it is really inaccurate. The word Islamicist means someone who studies Islam. It means it doesn't mean any more that I'm sympathetic in the sense of promoting Islam than a botanist promotes plants or a geologist promotes rocks. That's just a misreading of the term. To the extent that I believe there's something in the religion that appeals to people and that it's important to find out what it is that attracts them, and the fact that the Quran says the only miracle of Muhammad is the Quran itself, and so for Muslims there's something about the Quran that is beautiful and majestic, and to give some sense of why they might believe that, that's what I think a scholarly attitude is, and it makes no judgment whatsoever about the Quran as a whole, or about Islam as a whole, or about the relative peace or violence of Islam versus any other religion.
Did this book come out of any lectures that you've been giving throughout your career? I mean, you've obviously noticed that this is one particular book that is exceptionally difficult to read in English.
Yes, in fact, it came out of years of lectures where I found that the English translations, and by the way, for Muslims, those are not the Quran. Muslims, the vast majority, believe the Quran exists only in its Arabic form. That those texts only gave a very staticky image of the Quran. And they were confusing because Muslims don't read the Quran the way you would go and pick up a Quran and start from beginning to end. The order is a very strange order where the surahs in the last part of Muhammad's life come first, and they're all filled with issues of different tribes and political circumstances that take a lot of background. And the surahs that are most theological directly, without all of that historical detail, are come at the end of the Quran. They're the ones that Muslims learn first. They're the ones they memorized most. And they're the ones that people, very few people ever get to, because they get into about four or five pages of the Quran and they're discouraged. They can't figure out what's going on. So I decided there has to be a better way. In fact, I had a college-educated, literate, one of the most literate and open-minded people I ever met come up to me one day and said, "Sells, you got to do something about this. I go down and I pick up the Quran and I get in there 10 pages and I don't have a clue."
Michael Sells, I want to stop you for a second because I want to bring Jack Beatty into the conversation. Jack, what do you think about this controversy down at UNC? It seems all too American and less to do with the Quran.
Yeah, I say three cheers for the chancellor down there. I mean, this is it's one thing to do it at Swarthmore. It's something quite again to do it at a public institution.
Is there a point about the public institution and assigning a book specifically about religion in this way?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can understand what our friend from Mr. Crampton was saying. But on the other hand, this is in the context of the current world, this is almost a political text. I don't mean to say that it's political in the sense of, you know, it'll make you sway you one way or another toward Islam. But it's part now of history. It's central, as it's not been for America, for people in the West, for probably forever. And so I think the claim of that you're going to pick up the religion somehow by reading this, they aren't going to be reading it for the religion. They're reading it out of trying to find the answer. And I'm sure Professor Sells' students ask him, you know, what is the connection between this book and September 11th? That's not a religious question.
Yeah. I probably should have asked Stephen Crampton what he would have done if they were teaching the Book of Mormon rather than Karl Marx, since that is the real question. Mormonism is actually the fastest-growing branch of Christianity. That would have been interesting. We're going to come back. We're going to talk in more detail about teaching the Quran. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to On Point.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إذا السماء
انفطرت. We're talking about teaching the Quran in this hour, On Point listeners. And one of the most interesting things about the Quran is that it's primarily meant to be heard. Am I right, Michael Sells?
Yes, that's the way that the vast majority of Muslims experience it. And even when they read it themselves, they learn to recite it according to very complex and strict rules of recitation and pronunciation.
So when you teach the Quran to your students, you immediately encounter a very big problem, which is it really is meant to be spoken. We were listening to, what was that, Surah 82, Al-Infitar,
Al-Infitar.
Al-Infitar, which is called the cleaving or the breaking apart.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, in a sense, be speaking to them about a music that they whose lyrics they don't understand.
I think that's a good partial analogy on some sense that, you know, most Muslims who engage in, quote, translating the Quran into other languages don't call it a translation. They call it an interpretation or a rendition. And it's somewhat like looking at the musical score of a Mozart song that, you know, you've never heard. And so you can get a sense if you have a lot of music theory of what it means abstractly, but you don't have a sense of what it means to the listener and why those listeners would believe in what is a central Quranic belief that the Quran itself has an extraordinary quality in its language. And really, the meaning and the sound are in some sense inseparable, and that's what makes it so difficult just to get across in translation.
Well, when you sit down to translate, then you're dealing with meaning and a kind of abstract sound. How do you start work?
Well, this developed over, I worked on this for 15 years, and I started out by bringing in cassettes of the recitation, like the one you heard, with word-by-word glosses under the Arabic transliteration in English characters, so students could follow along and hear it. And they told me afterwards, they said, you know, everything we studied the rest of the class, whether it was history or theology or politics about Islam, became more meaningful because we got some sense of what the Quran was. And when we just looked at it in the English, it was so alienating and so really difficult to engage. The second thing is I tried to develop a way of translating it that doesn't impose upon it the King James Bible language, which grew out of a brilliant tradition of biblical thought and culture, and then was transposed kind of sideways onto a literary text which is fundamentally different in its literary structures and its rhetoric from the Bible. And that leads to all kinds of, you know, really awkward sentences that strike most people in the modern day as really almost caricatures.
I just wanted to read the translation from your book of Surah 82, or at least part of it, because I understand your point about not being able to go to where the King James Bible goes to in terms of use of the language. But I just want to read this opening, and it does have alliteration and a certain rhythm that strikes me as being very English. When the sky is torn, when the stars are scattered, when the seas are poured forth, when the tombs are burst open. Is that sort of what the Arabic sounds like? I mean, it does move you forward with a very profound rhythm.
Well, I work, you know, I also spend – You know, translation is my life. That's what I do. And so I worked on these for 15 years, and I had hundreds of people go over it, and well, at least dozens of people go over it and critique it. And so I hope it has a rhythm that sounds natural, but yet brings across the two qualities of the text that are meaningful to Muslims. And that is the majesty on the one hand and the sense of intimacy in it on the other.
Now, the intimacy, this is something that you write about. This isn't God speaking down. This is some kind of very intimate, whispered into the ear communication from the on high or something like that.
Well, that's the way Muslims, that's why it's so deeply meaningful to them, that you can say these cosmic things when the sky is splitting open, when the tombs are bursting open, then a soul will know what it has given generally or selfishly held back. And on the other hand, it's said in a way that has these undertones of a kind of intimacy that's there in the Arabic language, and it's brought out through different kinds of wordplay. And Quranic reciters and call this huzn. That's the main character that they see in good recitation. And it means a quality of kind of sad meditation on you know, the alienation of the human being from their God, and a kind of longing to overcome that alienation.
So when I read through this the tearing, my image, of course, is of either a priest or rabbi standing up in the pulpit, thundering about what terrible things await all of us because of our weakness as human beings. But in fact, it's almost the opposite if you go and listen to it as a Muslim.
Well, you know, there are all kinds of different passages about this central belief in Islam about the final judgment or the final moment of truth, where each person will see the deeds of their life, and those deeds will, you know, basically judge them. And in some of them, there is some hellfire and damnation imagery. And, you know, some Muslim commentators dwell on that aspect, saying, you know, you really have to make people afraid of what's going to happen in the afterlife in order to make them really, you know, be attentive in this life. But that's, in my view, and that's not the only message of those surahs. In theological terms, I think the other message is that it's bringing that moment of finality when each person looks back on their life up to them as if they were standing in that moment right now, and it makes them feel how significant that moment would be, and, you know, what the ultimate, you know, punishment or reward or anything like that at that, in that aspect of the text is not central.
Jack Beatty, do you feel this text is something close to the religion that you grew up with?
Well, no, very different. Oh, well, you know, I mean, I grew up with the Latin Mass, so sure. I mean, opaque and beautiful. I'm sorry, I dropped something. Opaque and yet beautiful words were part of my my growing up. But I wanted to ask, you know, Professor, you mentioned that there's the sadness here of people, someone reflecting on our alienation from being, from God. But of course, some people are more alienated than others. In the New Yorker last year, Bernard Lewis, the historian of Islam, yeah, said that Islam divides the world between a house of war and a house of faith. And the house of war is the people who are really alienated from God, namely the non-believers. Is that part of what's in your book, that element of the book and of Islam? And if it isn't in there, why?
Well, first of all, I disagree with that statement. Some Muslims view the world that way. But most Muslims look at those passages that talk about the unbeliever, what Mr. Crampton likes to quote about slay the unbelievers, and they view them in historical terms, that refers to the people that were attacking the early Muslims with Muhammad, and they were struggling with them. So I've met and talked to a lot of Muslims in my life, thousands, and I know very few Muslims who go around thinking about the house of war and house of peace. But there are some, and it's really important to know how to distinguish, because how you interpret the Quran on those issues will mean what your ideology ultimately is. But the reason I do not choose these more violent passages is the same reason that those passages come in the later section of the Quran, which I wasn't focusing on, is the same reason that in a Western Civ course, if you're reading selections from the Bible, what are you going to get? You'll probably get Exodus, and you'll probably get Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. What you won't get is the book of Joshua with its gruesome discussion of the God ordering the Israelites to slaughter the unbelievers, man, woman, and child, or those apocalyptic texts, gruesomely violent, that are the favorites of the Christian militia movements and that helped inspire Timothy McVeigh. They're important if you're discussing the issue of violence and religion. But this assignment and this book are not meant to get right to that issue, but they're meant just to introduce people to a sense of what some of the core theological beliefs of the Quran are about God and the human being.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Adam is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Adam.
Hi. I am a college student at the moment. And for two different classes, I've had to read Professor Tell's book. And one of them was a history class, and the other was a class on Iranian culture. And I viewed the book in both classes as a way to better understand what's behind what was going on. We learned about the expansion of Islam in my history class, and about how it affects the country of Iran in my other class. And I see it in this case too as a way to just educate people, and it doesn't seem to me like it's promoting any particular religion.
Right. Adam, do you have a question for Professor Sells, since you've got him on the line, about the connections? It's interesting to me that you read the book in two classes, both related to international affairs and politics, and I just wonder if you have any questions about the political nature of contemporary Islam that you'd like to put to him.
Not really. I really appreciate what you tried to do. It was very helpful to me in learning about what I was learning in the classes. It really helped, and I think that what you did was important for helping people to understand the world as a whole. I don't really have a question for him. I just thought that it would be important to know that this goes on in other colleges too, and probably 80% of the people at my school are required to read the Bible, or at least parts of it, and it's not a religious school. So,
what school is it?
Yeah, Colgate University.
Okay. Adam, thanks very much for your call. Listeners, we're talking about teaching Islam, and we're talking with Professor Michael Sells, whose book, Approaching the Quran, is a text that seeks to explain the process of translation, how Westerners can understand a book that is essentially meant to be heard in Arabic. Not a language most of us speak. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. Patty is calling from Sanger, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, I can't give as intelligent a commentary as Adam just did, but I'm a sort of mid-40s, upper-middle-class American woman, and I think everyone should be required to read the Quran or some aspect, some analysis of it, such as Professor Sells' book. This whole generation of young people will have their lives completely changed by our relationship with a culture that we clearly have no understanding of. And if we're so threatened by it, I just listen to people like that, and it resonates to the gentleman who's filing the lawsuit. It reminds me of my growing up in the Vietnam era and people saying, oh, those Eastern people, they don't respect individual life. They don't understand us. Well, we didn't understand them. And I just don't understand why this perpetuation of ignorance is a part of our culture. It's shocking to me. But I'm really glad to hear that students like Adam at fine schools like Colgate are going to just accept this as a normal part of their curriculum and as something that they need to bring themselves up to speed on in the world.
I'd like to comment on what you said, because I think it brings up a really important issue. The whole issue of the political situation is, since the end of the Cold War, it used to be in the Cold War, violence was channeled through the superpower rivalry. If you had a revolution against a government that was backed by the United States, you'd get help from the Soviet Union or vice versa.
Right,
that's gone. So now you're getting these international religious fundamentalisms. People acting in the name of one of them attacked the United States, but ferocious attack on Bosnian Muslims was carried out by Christian fundamentalists. And Hindu fundamentalists have attacked Muslims in India last spring, burning alive 1,000 and driving 100,000 to 200,000 out of their homes. This is a problem that everybody needs to understand.
Well, I think we should read everyone's religious text.
Every religious
text. The most frightening thing in the world
Absolutely.
Is fundamentalism, whatever guise it takes. Fundamentalism is really scary to me, and I was raised as a Southern Baptist, and I recently, to my 8 and 10-year-old daughters, decided that since I'm a way-lapsed Southern Baptist, I wasn't reading them enough of the Old Testament of the Bible. I started reading it, and when I got to the chapters you referred to, they looked at me with open faces like, why are you reading this to us? This isn't what we practice in our family. These people are just, you know, vindictively killing each other. And we have to also take into account the cultural context in which these treatises were originally written.
Patty, I want you to stay with us. I want to bring another caller into the conversation. Karen is on the line.
Hello. I just wanted to comment that I think comparative religion is the course to place this book in, because I think every religious text should be given equal treatment and not one text singled out, especially one that's written by a biased author. At least the biblical writings are supposedly objective writings or historical writings. And so I think that the context in which the focus is being put on this one text is really abnormal.
Well, Karen, I'm not sure that I can let you get away with saying that Michael Sells is biased, because we did discuss this. I mean, he is a professor of comparative religion.
Well, he's not a historian. He's not like a biblical scholar that's written the Bible. So what I'm saying is, in order to be fair to all religions and to give everybody an objective look, it seems to me that this should be placed in a comparative religion.
Let me address
the question, because I think that there is a valid issue in this question. You know, in my classes, in a class where you have a structured class and you have readings and you have multiple assignments, what I like to do is, if it's an introductory course, I like to focus on more than one religion. The course I focus now on does works on Islam, Hinduism, the Ojibwe American Indian religion, and the Igbo African religion. Because by doing that, every tradition sees that the same kind of scholarly questions are asked of the other tradition. So they don't feel like, oh, you know, these scholars are treating my tradition in this way. And it gives a sense of that comparative feeling. I agree with the caller on that. But I think there's a misperception about this assignment. This is just a summer reading assignment to equate someone with something of great significance. But it doesn't have the kind of structure that would allow a comparison of all the religions, just reading one book during the summer, or what the Family Policy Network wants, a discussion of religion and violence. I also teach a course on religion and violence, and boy, you really need a structured situation, because those issues can be inflammatory.
Michael, I have a structured situation right now. The music means we're coming to the break. We're going to pick up your point after it. I want to thank Patty and Karen for their calls. We're talking about teaching the Quran. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Here's another excerpt from a recitation of the Quran, Surah 97, Al-Qadr, Destiny.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Inna أنزلناه في ليلة القدر وما أدراك ما ليلة القدر.
We sent it down on the night of destiny, and what could tell you of the night of destiny? The night of destiny is better than 1,000 months. The angels come down, the spirit among them, by permission of their Lord from every order. Peace it is until the rise of dawn. Now, Michael Sells, the singing there was lovely. One of the interesting things in contemporary Islam, of course, is that the fast-growing sect of Wahhabism takes the singing out of it.
Well, First of all, I wouldn't call it singing. I would call it chanting or recitation. But you're absolutely right that there is a very fast moving movement, powerfully funded by major billionaires in our own ally, Saudi Arabia, that has really, over the last 15 years, imposed itself on many Islamic cultures. It comes in with vast resources. It's able to give money and to give scholarships and to train people in Arabic and send them to the holy cities, bring them back as imams, and it teaches that people, Muslims, should not associate with Christians or Jews, and a lot of other beliefs that ultimately aren't necessarily violent, but in my view are not peaceful. And in a society like ours, they're not helpful to have it for a diverse society. So I think to understand the different ways that a religious text is interpreted, and to see how this particular movement has grown, why it's so powerful, where it has spread. And one thing I'd like to say about the war is some people associate me, because I wrote on the Quran, as being kind of soft on the war on terror. I denounced the Taliban way before 9/11 precisely for that ideology that they were picking up from this extreme Wahhabism, and tried to warn people that they were, when they blew up those Buddhas, they were so dangerous that they would do anything. But nobody was heard then, because any to talk about then was wagging the dog. And the problem was not Islamicists. The problem was blind domestic politics.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Mohammed is on the line.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Mohammed.
I just wanted to I had an incident that happened to me. I wanted to point out in light of this discussion. A coworker came to me and said that, you know, a priest in the church that she goes to told her something about the Quran that wasn't true. And she came to ask me if it was or wasn't, and that God punishes people just for the sake of punishing them. And, you know, I keep a copy of the Quran in the office, and I told her, well, there it is. Read it. Where is it? Tell him where you found it. So there's this kind of, you know, misinformation about the Quran, and you can buy it from any bookstore. I mean, what's the problem? Just get it anywhere.
I think the biggest problem, Mohammed, is that most of the translations available in English really are hard going. I say to Professor Sells, he's done a wonderful job on these early surahs that he's translated, making them read like very fine poetry.
Yes.
You obviously...
Well, yes, I am aware of that, and some of them are really like old English and hard to read. But say, for example, Thomas Cleary is a good version also. I mean, I haven't read the professor's book, but I'm looking forward to. But really, an effort to make it more accessible is really a way to, you know, clear up a lot of misinformation.
I'd like to say one thing that Muhammad said that's very significant. When people either misrepresent a religious text or take a verse out of context, like saying, look at this verse, says kill the infidels, therefore Muslims are obligated by their God to kill all non-Muslims, then that has grave implications. It makes us feel, well, you know, if these people are obligated by God to kill us, should we trust them? Should we allow them into our police or our military? And there is that fear. And so to take these verses out of context and wave them around, I could do that with the Bible or any other religious text. I can take out a verse and make that whole religion sound fearful, is very dangerous. And in Bosnia, that kind of accusation led people to turn on people that had been their neighbors and friends all their lives, used to come to their Easter and Christmas celebrations to pay their respect, and end up putting them in concentration camps, because that fear can grow very fast.
Mohammed, I want to thank you for your call. Jack Beattie.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on the question I asked earlier that I wondered students must put to you, Professor Selden, just to get your response. What is the connection then between this book and September 11th?
Well, the connection is very similar to the connection between the Bible and those people that influenced Timothy McVeigh by their interpretation of the Bible and their violent ideology. And there's a lot more of those people around than most Americans realize. Now, I think it's the reason we don't think about that is because he's never called a Christian terrorist, but he read a book, The Turner Diaries, that's all filled with these quotes from the Bible and interpretations and a fantasy about what to do with it. So these are interpretations that come out of religious texts. It's not for me to say that that's not Islam or that's wrong or that's right. It's for me to point out all the different interpretations there are and point out those that are very dangerous in the world. And the thing about religions is that the reason that they can be so powerful, either for good or for bad, is because their symbolism is so deep. And so to understand that symbolism, then we can better understand how the same text could be used for acts of Christian compassion or to persecute Jews for 1,000 years, depending on how it's used, which texts are selected, how they're framed, and we can study how the Taliban selected certain violent texts, indoctrinated those poor boys who are mainly orphans, gave them a lot of hatred and political ideology, and used those texts to help instill them a violent mentality.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Craig is calling from Reichlake, Wisconsin.
Yeah, the reason I'm calling is that I went to school in the 60s, and that's Mao Tse-Tung and everything else. And I remember once sitting in the living room, and I was reading Mao's Red Book. My dad, a World War II veteran, came up, and he says, "Why are you reading that?" And I said, "Well, I want to know what a billion people are thinking." And what I'm seeing right now or listening to is a bunch of people that may or may not know the Muslim belief system. The thing is that you are selling students short if you don't think that they have the ability to rationally look at a series of questions or opinions by an author who may or may not know everything there is to know. But I think it's time you gave everybody a little bit of credit.
Craig, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're coming to the end of the hour. I just want to say that I take your point and I take it very seriously. We actually put that question to the lawyer who's instituting a suit against the University of North Carolina on behalf of some students who feel they shouldn't have to read the book. And he said that we were giving them too much credit to think that they could have these kinds of rational thoughts on their own. Craig, I want to thank you for your call. We really are coming to the end of the hour. And just very quickly to Michael Sells, in teaching the Quran, is it possible to simply teach it anymore as a religious text, or must it always be seen in the political context of the contemporary world?
Well, I never teach the Quran in the sense of teaching it as a religious text. I think that I wouldn't use that expression because I would say that's what, you know, a rabbi teaches the Hebrew Bible as a religious text. A priest Christian teaches a Christian Bible. An imam teaches the Quran as a religious text. What I do is try to teach about the Quran and try to have students get some sense of why, you know, what are the central ideas that are the grounding, most meaningful things for 1.2 billion people. And that's what it's about. It is a delicate thing in this country, but we have to face it. And UNC did service. I'm sorry.
Okay. Professor Sells, I've got to end it there. Thank you very much for joining us. The book is Approaching the Quran. My guest was Professor Michael Sells. This is On Point. The prestigious Kamehameha School in Hawaii has dropped its century-old policy of only admitting students with Hawaiian ancestry. For native Hawaiians, who have seen their monarchy, language, and culture decimated over the past 100 years, the school represented one of the few institutions they could still call their own. But concerned about a possible legal challenge, the trustees of the school have abandoned their Hawaiians-only admissions policy. how Nanike Trask is a professor of Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii. In this radio diary, she explains why she and other Native Hawaiians are furious that the Kamehameha school has been opened up to what she calls an outsider.
The United States invaded our country in 1893 and overthrew our queen, Liliuokalani, and put in her place an all-white sugar planter oligarchy. Then Hawaii was annexed without popular referendum, something like 5-6 years later. And so our chiefs, towards the end of the 19th century, began to leave their lands and their wealth, such as their wealth may have been at that time, to various Hawaiian institutions that they created to benefit their people, because, as in many societies, the obligation of the chiefs was to care for their people. And in this sense, this school for the education of Hawaiian children was part of the larger obligation to care for the Hawaiian people. And that genesis of the will required that the children who were to be educated would be Hawaiian, for obvious reasons, because that's the legacy that a Hawaiian ruler would leave for the next generations of their people. For us, it's not a matter of race, it's a matter of indigeneity. Who was here first? Who are the Aboriginal people? Just as it would be for the Maori or the Aboriginals of Australia or the Native Americans of North America. The difference for the Americans is they are obsessed with race. And that's really what's hanging behind this decision by the trustees, is that the United States Supreme Court is very conservative now, and they have been striking down anything they deem to be based on race, despite the fact that all indigenous peoples know that race is not the issue. But to the United States, everything that is not based on their national story, which is of immigration into a vacant land, smacks of race. In fact, this is not a question of race. It's a question of an indigenous people whose heritage and inheritance are now being forcibly taken away. This is another great blow to our people. Since the moment of contact, when Captain Cook stepped on our shores and tried to take one of our chief hostages and suffered his deserved fate, which was death, this is exactly what is in that continuation of Western contact, Western taking, Western colonization. It's just another attempt to take away whatever we have left to us. And the suffering is very real, and it isn't just the parents. The students, too, are feeling very badly, because there are many families, as my own family, where two of us, there were six of the children in our family, two of us were admitted to Kamehameha schools, and the other four were not. And that feeling of being passed over, of being left out, stays with a child, even into adulthood, because it signals that you are less than the rest. You are not capable. And in this case, the parents were so outraged, the Hawaiian parents, because this child that was let in is not Hawaiian. So it breaks the intent of the princess's will. And it hurts all those children and parents whose ability is looked upon as not good enough. Not only did they fail to make the cut into the school, but now they have someone who's a complete foreigner being let in. And that's where I think the rage and the pain were most deeply felt, in the exclusion of Hawaiian children for the purpose of including a non-Hawaiian child.
Haunani K. Trask is a professor of Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii. She's a 1967 graduate of the Kamehameha School. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. Our phone